Hey everybody! In this episode, I'll be interviewing Chuck Wren. Chuck Wren is someone who had a heavy involvement in the Richmond music scene from the first psychedelic dance in Virginia all the way up to High on the Hog. He's lived in Richmond his whole life and has been part of some crazy scenes. I love Chuck. I've known Chuck since I was born and he helped to raise me, so this is a very special episode to me.
The music used is an improvised piece by Peter Lion Huff that he recorded in my basement for this interview.
All right, man, what you got in mind? What do you want to talk about?
You were telling me earlier that you used to explore abandoned buildings in Richmond. Did you ever have an encounter with the police?
My closest experience with old buildings and police was there was an empty building downtown, not all the way downtown, but I guess around First Street, I'll say, a few sheets somewhere along in there. It was a vacant building that had a stained glass window in the side of it. And me and my brother-in-law at the time, he said, man, I'd really like to get that stained glass window. And I said, all right, we've got anything. So we took our tools, just hand tools, you know, to go in and prize that window out and take it out. Well, we were in there working on the window and somebody called the cops. So the cops showed up at the place. There was no way out. You know, we couldn't get out. The cops were coming in the house. So he and I opened the door and got behind the door up against the wall. And the cops came in with the flashlight and looked all around and walked out of the room. We were right behind the damn open door up against the wall. Yeah, boy, that was a hell of a night.
Yeah, what else happened that night?
Just waited for the cops to leave. If they'd have had a dog, we'd have been shit.
That's a great story, Chuck. On to music.
When was the first show you organized?
The first big one, I started out doing that stuff in high school. And I had friends in bands and I put on a show where advertise it around school and, you know, a couple of hundred people would come, would rent a place and put on a show. But the first really big one I did was there used to be a ballroom called Tantilla Ballroom. It was down on Broad Street. It has a really long and great history. It was considered to be the major ballroom in the South. Back during the
wow.
It's been torn down. But me and a couple of my buddies rented this ballroom and put on the first psychedelic dance in the state of Virginia. And we rented a bunch of equipment and stuff to put the show on. And we rented so much, we sold the show out and rented so much equipment we lost money on it. That was a big one. And gosh, since then, you know, there's countless shows,
mm-hmm.
you know, on up to like High on the Hog. Now, I'm not the only guy that was doing High on the Hog.
Tell me about Woodstock. Did you have any role in organizing it?
I didn't have anything to do with putting it on. But before that, there was a festival called Atlantic City Pop, and it was mm-hmm. in Atlantic City. You're probably familiar with it. And a buddy of mine had a leather goods store and made sandals and belts and vests and things. And he was going to go up and had a booth up there to sell the stuff that he made. And so he asked me if I wanted to come along and help him, and I did. And it was a great time, great time. I saw a lot of great bands. And we were just up there running his booth. But I noticed a lot of people were wearing tie-dyed shirts and people were selling them and stuff up there. So I came back to Richmond and said, you know, we can do this at Woodstock. So my wife and I and a couple of friends started tie-dyeing t-shirts in the kitchen at our apartment. And we tie-dyed a shit ton of them, man. You just go out and buy cases of white Hanes t-shirts and come home and had a couple of big pots on the stove and, you know, we were tie-dyeing t-shirts. We tie-dyed a bunch of them. And my wife and I, we were the only two people that went up to Woodstock. We loaded up all the t-shirts and went up to Woodstock to sell t-shirts. We got up there on Thursday before they closed the interstate and got within about a mile from the stage. Well, you know, it was fairly close at the time. But people were just coming in and parking on each side of the road. So if you were there, you weren't going anywhere. There wasn't any way you were going to get out. So we set up our little tie-dye shirt thing. I had some pipe, and we put it open the doors and duct taped the pipe to it, started hanging up the T-shirts. And also, we're selling T-shirts up there, tie-dye T-shirts. I had a big cooler of beer with me, and it was going great. We, you know, we're selling it. But then people started coming by, and guys come by and say, you know, I really like to get this shirt, but I don't have any money. Would you take a, you know, some hash for a weed, bag of weed? And, you know, yeah, sure. So we're doing that. We're swapping. Now the other people would come by, you know, I don't have any money either, but I'd like to shirt. Would you take swap some acid for it? And next thing I know, you know, we've got hash and pot and acid along with the T-shirts. So I set a sheet over the hood of the car and just started putting it out there with, you know, prices on the stuff that we've swapped for. So we said, now we're selling tie-dye T-shirts, hash, pot, LSD. We never got to the stage until Sunday. We were there, got there on Thursday. But it was just such a crazy scene. And then people were going, oh, because I'm drinking a beer. Guys, you got any more of that beer? You want to sell one? I'm sure. So I'm selling beer. You know, it was crazy. Just crazy as shit.
How did you get to know Bruce Springsteen?
Well, Bruce started coming to town. First time I saw Bruce and his band was in Monroe Park, and they came down and played Free one afternoon. Nobody ever heard of them. They were just kids from New Jersey. And they came down in a beat up old truck with some equipment and stuff and set up in Monroe Park and played. And I knew they were going to be a big deal because even as kids, they were, I guess Bruce was like 18 or something like that. And they were good from the start. First time I ever saw them, I went, man, these guys are going to be something. And they were one of the first bands, maybe the first band I ever heard that mic'd all the amps through the PA. So instead of just having the amp and playing with that volume, they put microphones in it and put it into the PA so you get this huge sound. And so they were doing that. First time I had ever seen that done. And I knew they were going to be a big deal. And they obviously turned out to be. But they'd come to Richmond. They didn't have a lot of places to play. And they had Asbury Park in New Jersey and all up that way. But not much. And Richmond got to be one of the places that was real popular for them. And they'd come down here every month or two, I guess, and play. And I got to be friends with them and did a bunch of posters for the band and that kind of stuff. And just liked them, you know, and did silkscreen posters. And they used to, Bruce never stayed at my house, but most of the band did. And at that time, my wife at that time would make up like a big spaghetti dinner. Mm-hmm. And we'd feed the band, and they'd sleep on the floor and whatnot. But yeah, we did that for a while. They got to where they didn't need to sleep on my floor anymore. But we did that. I knew Bruce, and Bruce used to come to my apartment and eat dinner and stuff. But Bruce always pretty much stayed to himself. He wasn't. He wasn't a party guy at all. He didn't drink, didn't take any drugs, you know, didn't smoke pot or drink or anything like that. And the rest of the guys pretty much were rolling. You know, they were a rock and roll band.
Speaking of pot, didn't you have a club called the Health Club?
Yeah, THC.
Yeah.
Is what it stood. It wasn't anything official. It was just some guys, friends of mine. And we had a little group called the Health Club. And we'd go out basically at that time we were into 10-speed bikes, and we'd go out to the park and be in training and go out there like early in the morning and ride laps and stuff. And then and we had another group called the Bothers. It was me and a couple of friends, the Bothers.
What
and
does that mean?
Our motto was, we do both. And I drew a picture, a t-shirt up, that had a joint and a bottle of beer walking down the street arm in arm. And the beer was beer was holding a joint, and then the joint was drinking and holding a beer. And it was called the Bothers. We do both. But, you know, it was a real, all those apartments around Harrison Street and Park Avenue and all that's where a lot of kids lived. And it was a real social thing. I mean, somebody knock on the door, you go to the door, hey, what's happening? Come on in, you smoke a joint. And, you know, just, I mean, it was just that kind of, everybody would visit and hang out and, you know, play records and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Tell me about your drug experiences.
Taken, well, not every drug, but I've taken a lot of drugs, but not for any length of time. Just for the experience
just
of doing
experience
it.
Of it.
Are there any trips you remember distinctly?
One experience, I used to live on the corner of Harrison Street and Grove Avenue, two blocks in. It was a three-story building that burned down. It's not there anymore. But I had an apartment on the third floor. And I had taken some acid. And across the street was a laundromat, and they had a soft drink dispensing machine in there. And I decided I would like to have a Coke, you know, or a soda. And I came downstairs and stood on the sidewalk. There's a stoplight right there. And I was waiting, and the light would change. And I'd step off a couple of steps, and the light would change back. And I'd back up. I never could get across the street. I ended up just going back up to my apartment. It was just crazy shit like that, you know.
Yeah.
Funny stuff. It was all in good fun. It wasn't anything at the time about it. I mean, it was just everybody laughing a lot.
I said, where did the laughter go?
That's what I know. I'm wondering.
What time was this?
That was the late 60s, early 70s. Then it got to a point where cocaine came on the scene, and that was a whole different thing. You know, it was just, that was awful.
In the 80s?
Yeah, it would have been the disco time.
Cocaine and disco.
Yeah, not any fun. Neither one.
When did you buy your house in Church Hill?
I bought that house with my first wife in 1975. I was there 45 years, and Holly has been there, was there with me for 25 years.
And you bought it when the area was completely different?
Trashed.
Yeah.
Yeah, really. It was real dangerous to be up there. It was not a developed place like it is today at all.
Not a place to raise children, too.
No, I mean, dangerous. I got shot twice while I was living up there. It was not a good neighborhood. Most of those houses were just flop houses, you know, crack houses, rented out. When I bought my house, I took every room. The upstairs of the house was uninhabitable. It was just too in such bad shape. The downstairs of the house had padlocks on every door and a heater in the middle of the floor, and then mattresses. I took 15 mattresses out of that place when I bought it.
People were squatting.
To the dump. Yeah, it's just a crack house, all, you know.
And he has pictures of all of that. So weird.
Yeah. Yeah, but it was a really bad neighborhood. I mean, our parents thought we were nuts to buy that house, you know, that we were going to get killed. It you go into Libby Park, and it's just syringes and wine bottles and liquor bottles laying in the, you know, around the trees, and you couldn't go out at night. And then,
well, you should. Speaking of which, you have two bullets in your body from being shot up there.
Yeah, I told him that.
You did?
Okay. I had gotten. I was in a robbery. I wasn't robbing, but I was being robbed, and ended up getting shot twice. Once in my side here, and once in my butt over here. I was obviously running. He got shot me in the back.
This was at your workshop, right?
Yeah, I had a workshop that I rented with another guy. It was up at 33rd and Marshall as well.
That's what I heard, yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't on Franklin Street, no. I've been half shot a lot of times, but, you know, when you get really shot, it burns. It's just hot. It's like somebody hit you really hard with a paddle. That's what it feels like. But it didn't do any real damage. I was in the hospital 5 days. But it wasn't life-threatening or anything. It didn't hit anything. So they just left them in.
So they're still in there.
Yeah.
There was a certain story I heard about you and Churchill regarding your dog. Tell the story, Chuck.
This was my first dog with my first wife, Myra the Dancer. We lived on Franklin Street. And we had separated, and it was just me and the dog on Franklin Street, and my wife had moved into another place. And I was working in the restaurant business, as usual. The dog was real old, and I had put a sheet and some plastic down in the downstairs room. Dog was incontinent and whatnot. Put the food bowl down. It was warm in the summer. I had a window fan in there for the dog, and I came back from work that one night, and the dog had eaten dinner, laid down in front of the fan, and died. It was just there. And I thought, oh my God, what am I gonna do? And I wrapped the dog up in a sheet and said, I'll just have to deal with it in the morning, you know. And I went upstairs. I couldn't sleep, you know. It was just I just couldn't sleep like that. So I came back down and put the dog in my van and got a shovel and put on my boots and went over to Libby Park at the Overlook over there, which is where we used to always walk. And I dug a significant grave for the dog to be put into at the Overlook. And there was a cop up there named Mongo was his name, and he was a really good guy and friend of everybody on Churchill. Everybody knew him. He was like back when you had the police had a beat. His beat was our neighborhood, and everybody knew him. I mean, he'd stop and help people take groceries in the house, and, you know, he was a good friend. So he pulled up and wanted to know what I was doing, and I had the dog was still wrapped up in the sheet in the truck, and I'm digging this grave. You know? So he says, well, what's going on? And I told him, and I was tearful and sentimental and all that. And I said, I'm my old dog died, and I'm burying my dog here. I said, I know I shouldn't be doing it, but this is a special place, and so forth and so on. He said, okay. He said, you know, I'll let you go do that with no problem, but first I need to look at the dog. I opened the truck and showed him the dog and pulled the blanket back on, and he said, okay, go ahead. So I finished burying the dog and all that, and the night was over. But yeah, it was pretty damn funny. He was I don't mind what you're doing, but I need to look at the dog.
Make sure it's not a person.
Make sure it's not my wife. Yeah, it's pretty funny.
It's hilarious.
Yeah, it was. It is now. It was
not then.
It was rough then, yeah. Yeah, funny.
Hey, thanks for listening. Next up, I'm interviewing Ken Montgomery, who ran the Generator Sound Art Gallery in New York.